Well, good evening, everybody. We are going to begin our study, or pick up where we left off, on our study of the book of James. There are, again, all the lessons are online on the Embry Hills main landing page. So if you go there, you can download all of the lessons at one time, or just print out the ones that you want one at a time, because it's like, what, 23 pages, babe? Is that how much it is? Yeah, so it's 23 pages long. But if you want to get that done, I would strongly encourage you to do that. We do have a few lessons in the back. If you raise your hands, James will bring it to you if you need a lesson for tonight. Lesson 3 is in the back as well, so as you leave this evening, you can go ahead and get that. So, Clayton, would you lead us in a prayer before we begin, please? Amen. Okay, real quick, what do we know precisely about who the author is? The only thing we really know for sure is what he calls himself. What does he call himself in the very first verse? He calls himself a servant, and this kind of servant, just from a memory standpoint, this kind of servant is, you do not have the right to say no to your master. That's what this kind of servant is. You are inclined to do what you're... Now, do you have the physical capability to say no? Sure you do. But you don't have the right. You're not supposed to say no to your master. And that's who wrote this book. Now, we're going to take it from the assumption that this is James, the Lord's brother, that has written this particular book. But it's important to know that he calls himself a servant. And who did he write to, also in the first verse? Who's his audience? He just calls him something simple. The 12 tribes of the dispersion, I guess. Some of your translations might have that worded slightly different. Who is that? Who are the 12 tribes of the dispersion? Yeah, Jewish Christians, right. I mean, it's kind of a mix, I think, between physical Israel and spiritual Israel, right? So he's writing to Jews, but he's writing to Jewish Christians. And that's going to be the audience that he's going to target. And again, I think that's going to help us understand some of the things that he says as he goes through this letter. Why do you think he wrote this letter, though? Now, this is James, the Lord's brother, maybe the elder of the church of Jerusalem. Why do you think he wrote this letter? The whole goal, by the way, for the whole book, the whole letter that he wrote, is to help these fairly new Jewish Christians move towards spiritual maturity. And so he's an elder, and he sees all these new Christians kind of coming and going, right? So he's kind of watching, so he's looking out of his window, and he's watching these Jewish Christians, new converts relatively so, coming and going back and forth, and he doesn't really like what he sees. Now, they're still learning, but these are the kind of people that say the right thing, but don't always do the right thing. Does that ever apply to anybody here? Right? We know the right answer, but we don't always live out that right answer, do we? And that's kind of what James is seeing in this whole unfolding of Christianity in the early stages of the church. And, you know, as opposed to Martin Luther calling it an epistle of straw, you look at, you know, all these different sins that James is going to address. This is a letter of common sense, if you will. Do any of these sins exist today? Every one of them exists today. And so to tell me that this particular letter doesn't have any meat in it, you know, that is ludicrous thinking in my mind, because all of these things, hypocrisy, listening and not doing, improper use of riches, respecter of persons, worldliness, all these things still exist today. And the thing that James is going to do throughout this study, and I mentioned that he steps on our toes, you know, quite a bit, but he's not going to allow us to keep Christianity, our own Christian faith, in the academic or theoretical world. He just won't allow it. He is going to insist that you take your learning, all those right answers, and he's going to make you understand that it's imperative that you start doing the right answers. So he's not going to, you know, a lot of us are very good Sunday and Wednesday Christians. And apparently a lot of James's first readers were the same way. And he just won't allow it. He's going to not give us a whole lot of comfort throughout this letter. He's going to give us a lot of instructions, a lot of commands, but ultimately it's one of those things that we have to adhere to in practice. Throughout these 13 lessons, we're going to talk a lot about faith. What is faith? Tell me what faith is. Now, that's a Sunday morning word. We all ought to know the right answer to that. What is faith? Give me another name for that. Yes. You know, so you have this. It is the same Greek word. So you have trust and confidence. You saw the slides beforehand, right? So you have this active sense of trust and confidence. I'll just put them all up there. Throughout the book, these are the three things that it talks about. And to Marty's point is, faith always begins as a mental exercise, doesn't it? As what I would call a mental ascent. You realize who Jesus Christ is. And you realize that you are lost in sin, and you realize that you need Him as your Savior, and so you obey the gospel. Well, before you even get to the obeying of the gospel, that's just mental, right? You're just realizing some things. But faith that saves, the kind of faith that James is going to talk about, has to go further than that mental exercise, doesn't it? Any faith that just stays as a faith only, if you will, if I can borrow that term, any faith that stays there is not a saving faith, because that's not the kind of faith that James is going to talk about. He's going to talk about trust and confidence. You can trust a rope all day long that it can hold your weight, but until you jump on that rope and prove that it's strong enough to hold your weight, then you don't have faith in that rope. It's got to compel you to do something with that mental ascent, with that belief. And all these things that James is going to address for us are imperative in our faith. And you can't exercise these things without practice, without doing the things that James talks about. It can't stay as just a mental thing and giving the right answers without doing the right answers. So that's kind of the roadmap, I guess, that we're going to look at. And this evening, you know, just covering verses 1 through 12, you know, we're going to talk about our attitude toward trials, the advantage. I mean, so trials are there. You know, the obvious question is why? And then, you know, what kind of assistance does God give me in order to help me get through all these different trials that he's going to describe? And I would tell you, while not difficult to understand, this part of James, these first 12 verses, are some of the most difficult verses to put into practice in the entire New Testament. It's right up there with the golden rule. It's right up there with turning the other cheek. How hard are those two things to do? I mean, we tell our kids, right? You know, the golden rule, do unto others. And we tell them to turn the other cheek. How hard is that to do? Very hard, isn't it? Somebody slaps you, Joel, you inclined just to turn your face and allow me to slap the other side? You're bigger than me, so I'd never do that. It's hard, right? And these things that James is going to ask us to do, consider it all joy when you fall into trials. He starts right off with, basically, a slap in your face. Because that's a very difficult thing for you to do. So I would tell you, while not hard to understand what James is trying to get us to do here, it's really hard to practice. Because when a trial comes into your life, it's difficult. And what James is going to help us understand is not only what kind of attitude we ought to have, but he's going to try to help us understand what good those trials do for us. Because they have a design. It isn't just an arbitrary thing that God is asking of us. They have a purpose in mind, and I think that's the thing that James wants us to understand, and also that we're not alone in that either, that God is there with us, and he's going to give us some help with that. One of the things we said on Sunday was that this book is filled with commands. And so you immediately you have this idea of counting. So again, just a command. You need to count it all joy when you fall into various trials. You need to know an understanding of the mind. You need to let. This is an allowing aspect. And this is an asking. So these action words, these verbs that he hits us with that are also commands. These aren't arbitrary. These aren't opinions. If you want to make it through life, you're going to do these things. You're going to count. You're going to know. You're going to let. And you're going to ask. Those are important things that each one of us needs to apply to our lives and make sure that we're doing these four things on a regular basis, because that's what James is going to try to get us to understand and, most importantly, to get us to try to do. So let's pick up in verse 2 then. Count it all joy, my brothers, when you meet trials of various kinds. I think all of this is going to be from the ESV. So the word count, you know, so right off the bat you have this whole count it all joy. This is an internal attitude with forward type thinking, if you will. This whole counting. It's a financial term that literally is an evaluation. So you evaluate your circumstances and you place a value on them. And James is telling you to put a lot of value. Evaluate all these trials that you go in contact with. Understand them, deal with them, and don't neglect them. Because again, they certainly have a purpose. And it has with it the idea of leading the way, if you will. And so it is a dependence on all these things. In Job chapter 23, you know, when all these things, basically Job says, when I am tried, I'm going to come out like gold. So Job is in the middle of awful things, but he's counting on them. He is allowing them to have a place in his life, and he is allowing them to lead the way because they're taking him somewhere, and he's going to allow it. Did Job always like what was happening to him? And the answer is no. But he was counting on those trials. And then we get to this paradox, and this that we are to count it all joy. What would that imply? What is joy? Let's start with that. What do you think joy is all about? Is joy what's the difference between joy and happiness? Let's start there. Yeah, happiness is the things that happen to you, right? Joy is an internal kind of attitude that no one can rob you of your joy. And James doesn't say to be joyful for trials, but to be joyful in them. And the other important aspect that he says is that these are things, he says, when they're going to happen, not if. And the older I get, it's becoming more clear that it's when trials happen and not if they're going to happen as you get older. But this whole idea of all joy, This is a it's an entirety. It is completely. The word all, that noun, has to agree with the noun that follows it. So every circumstance, we're not supposed to, as Christians, we're not supposed to, at the end of a day, take all the things, all the circumstances, all the events that happen to us in the day and say, okay, well, these are bad. These three or four are bad. These five or six are good. And these two or three were excellent. He's saying they all have a purpose. And they all do something for you. Consider it all joy. The entirety of your entire day, good or bad, consider it all joyously. And that's a hard thing to do, isn't it? It's when you're going through trials, when things aren't going the way that you want them to go. And the whole question that you need to constantly be asking yourself is, how do I take these various trials that I'm going through, and how do I make something out of them? How do I take advantage of the opportunity that's been given to me? And so that is the joy. We need to start looking at it in that way. Somebody turn to Hebrews chapter 12 and verse 2. Doug, can you read that for me? Hebrews 12 and verse 2. Yeah, so Jesus was able to look at the cross with joy because he could tell where they were taking him. And what James is going to do for us is he's going to tell us why. These aren't just trials like a puppeteer might do to, you know, his creation. These have a design for us, something that God intends to make us stronger, and they lead us towards something. So there's a purpose to all of those things, and we need to take advantage of each and every one of those opportunities that are given to us. And then this word trials, and it is this whole idea of putting something to the test. The word experience is a good one. These things that might try us. These are not temptations, by the way. These are not they can turn into temptations if we poverty, hunger can turn into a temptation to steal, obviously. But these are just trials. These are things that you and I fall into just by being human beings, just by living on this earth. There are trials that come our way. There's death, there's sickness, there's earthquakes, there's things that go on. There's loss of jobs. There's all kinds of things that happen to us that are called trials. And these are just various. And they're things that will come upon each and every one of us in one form or fashion. And we just need to learn how to deal with it. That's what all that simply means is to know what those trials are. And the other part that I think is important when we look at the various or the fall into type of thing. Whenever you have a trial, you got to know that everybody else, somebody around you, is much worse off than you are. You know, I've told this story before, and I apologize. Some of you have heard this a million times. I was in a sociology class at University of Texas. I was in the middle of going through chemotherapy. So I was losing some of my hair. I had lines on me for the radiation treatment, all that stuff. And the teacher, first night of class, says, okay, I want to start over here, and everybody tell us the worst thing that you're going through right now. And I'm thinking to myself, well, this is going to be embarrassing because I've got all these people beat. I've got the worst problem of anybody in this class of 25 people. I happen to be like the last person that he came to. By the time it came my turn, I was embarrassed because I only had cancer. That was like a minor problem compared to everything else these poor people were having to go through. People are worse off than you are. No matter how bad it seems, these trials that you go through, somebody else is worse off. And it's helpful, I think, to realize that things can be bad. And yet, even when they are bad, there's that purpose that we keep talking about, and it's falling into, and then you have these various kind of circumstances. Yes, sir. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I think all trials can become temptation. James is going to switch from trials, things that just various and sundry, multicolored is the way that word is defined. Multicolored kind of events that happen to you. And beginning in verse 13, he's going to move on to temptations. Those things that entice us to do evil, to sin. And he makes this switch. But yeah, I do think that the trials lead us to something more spiritual. You know, whatever, even the events that happen to people, the earthquakes, the loss of jobs, the hunger that might exist, those things can lead us to a higher spiritual plane, if you will. And I think that's a really important aspect to look at the different things that you and I have to go through as we go through life. And then verse 3, knowing, so, you know, consider it all joy when you go through trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces or works patience or endurance or perseverance. What is, you know, from the word know standpoint, it is this long Greek word, I'm not even going to bother. Gnosko is its base word. And that particular word is about experiences. It's a recognizing. It's knowledge based on experiences. If I read a book on baseball, Smitty, so I'm reading this book on baseball, never played it before, I've read the book from cover to cover, am I now qualified to go out and play baseball? Just because I understand there's this round thing, and I've got this wooden stick in my hand, and there's these four bases I've got to run around. I mean, I'm ahead of most people, but you're not qualified. You know why? I don't have any gnosko. I don't have any experience. I've got this knowledge based off of pure book reading, but I don't have any experience to fall back on. And so, it you know, just reading the book, while helpful, good place to start, it can't stop there, because life is full of gnoskos, if you will, pardon that. That's what life is full of. And we need to take advantage of all those different experiences and know, count on where they are leading you. And that's it is active. It is a continually finding something out, a continually wanting to know something about those from every single experience. And now we have this idea of testing or proving once again. My dad used to work in a steel mill when I was a little boy, and the one image that I have in my brain is they would take all the scrap metal and melt them in these absolutely enormous furnaces. But then somebody would have to put on this heat gear and go up to the furnace and get this stick thing and wipe all the sludge off the top of the metal. And it just, this was an ongoing process. You would wipe it off, you'd wait, come back in 30 minutes, somebody else, they'd rotate that lousy job around, and somebody else would have to skim the impurities of the metal off the top of this melted metal. This is the idea of testing and proving. It is the idea of allowing all those impurities to come floating to the top. That's what this is all about. And I think it's important. Turn to Malachi 3, verse 3. Malachi 3 and verse 3. Jake, can you read that for me, please? You know, there's a whole sermon that one could have on this whole refining of silver. It is the idea of the silversmith taking silver and putting it directly into the hottest part of the flame, and he has to be very attentive that the silversmith can't just lay it there and walk away and come back later, because if the silver stays in that hot flame for too long, the silver gets ruined. But he keeps it there just the right amount of time, and you're going to say, well, how does he know when it's the right time? Because it builds a reflection. And the silversmith can see his own reflection in that silver. That's what God is for us. He is the refiner of silver. He will allow these trials, these hot things to come over us. But when he sees his reflection, when we become more like him, he will pull us out of that trial. He's always there. He is always attentive. He is always watching. He is always making sure that it's not too much. Sometimes we think that God expects too much from us. Sometimes we don't have as much confidence in ourselves as God does. But God knows us better than we know ourselves. God knows how much we can take. And He will be there for us. And again, this is that whole idea of letting and asking and knowing the purpose behind all of these things. And so it is that whole idea of being watchful over us. And then this idea of faith again that we've already talked about, because it this testing of your faith. No faith is a real faith until it has been tested by fire, until it has been proven by getting all the impurities to the top. That until that happens, your faith really isn't a faith that's going to survive the hard times, until you have that tested faith that goes over and over again. And it's this producing or working idea that's important. You know, this idea, it's this whole working or producing is more of a goal. So from this particular Greek word, it is the goal that's doing this producing. This working is to a specific end. In the next verse, he's going to use a totally different word for work. But this particular word is got the goal in mind. It's got that end game in mind. And it's that trust, that faith that we have to have, that we have to know that it's going in a particular direction. And I think one of the things that might help us is to know that no trial is ever going to leave you empty. That again, there's always something. It's going to either work to establish us, to complete us, to make us perfect, or if we don't let it have that work, then it's going to leave us with nothing. But the design of these trials is to work us toward that goal. And one of the main goals is this idea of patience. This think of it as a heavy load just on your shoulders, and you're having to carry this terrible heavy load around. Patience is the ability to abide under that weight without your knees giving out. God will give you the weight that kind of weights you down, but you know, that's as much as He's going to do. Have you ever, anybody been on a cruise before? A cruise ship before? Yeah, it's a lot of fun. Probably the best vacation you'll ever have, because your phone won't work, you eat all you want, and you could take as many naps all day as you want. Great, great vacation as far as I'm concerned. One of the things I realized about a ship, and sailors will tell you this, is that a ship that when we went out, it was full of a lot of food, a lot of weight was on that ship. When we got to the furthest point and we turned around to come back, they offloaded all the garbage. So it was only half as full as it was when we went out. Most people got seasick on that ship. There was a hurricane brewing in the Atlantic Ocean, and it tossed a lot of people around. It was a very rough ride because there was no weight. That's what they told us, is that the waves were probably the same going out, but since there was so much weight on the ship, it cut through all those big waves. It was able to pierce them without rocking everybody all over the place. Without the weight, you then become tossed all over the place because you don't have anything holding you down, securing you, anchoring you to where you need to be. So that's what patience is all about. That's that holding you down a little bit. Just that extra weight that we need. This whole idea of patience, or sometimes your translations will call it steadfastness or perseverance or endurance. But it is that same thing as like the silversmith. The blacksmith will put metal into a fire to make it pliable, to make it so that he can form it into something that is more useful, as opposed to just being a stick of iron. Now I can make something of you, God is saying. Now that I've put you into that fire, now that you have started to develop patience, now I can do something with you. And that, I think, is his overriding message that he wants us to get understand. then you have this advantage. So that is all the attitude that we're supposed to have, this attitude of joy, knowing that it's going to produce all this patience, which is one of the advantages that I think we have. And let patience, or steadfastness, have its full effect, or perfect work, that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. And for me, when you look through that particular sentence right there, to again this idea of letting it, it just cannot be interrupted. It is something that you and I have a choice in. We can choose not to let it, and we can choose to let it. If we choose not to let it, then we will not take advantage of any of the benefits that God is trying to get us to see. We won't grow. We won't become malleable. We won't become useful if we don't let them have their uninterrupted goal that they want to produce within us. And again, you have this idea of perfect work. Let patience have its perfect work. And again, this also has the idea of the goal that is in mind. It is, it is not perfection. This idea of being perfect is not perfection. It is the idea of helping us get to the end, helping us get to the goal. Yes, ma'am. Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's a good point. I don't know if any of you remember Leo Vassar, the Vassars that used to attend here. Their oldest son, Grant, was born incredibly premature, incredibly so. And it was touch and go there for Grant's first month or two of his life. Leo came to church one Wednesday night, and he was very restless, and he and I went for a walk, and we prayed together, and his comment was, to your point, is, I don't know how people get through life without that, and pointing to the saints that were inside at the time praying for his son. And it's true. How does the world get through life, as we said, just the things that you go through, how do they get through them without a support group, without having that relationship with God? And I don't know. I don't know that there is an answer. I think they might fake it through life, but sometimes it's a very miserable life because they don't have an anchor. Yes, ma'am. Yeah. Right. 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 Yeah. Right. Right. Yeah, what you said reminded me of the 23rd Psalm. I walk through the valley of the shadow of death. It doesn't say I stop in the middle of the valley. It doesn't say I stumble and fall and I can never get out of that valley of death. It says I walk through it. It's scary. It's unpleasant. But I walk through it only because the shepherd has gone before me. And the shepherd is leading me through that dark valley. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. That is a difficult thing while you're going through it. A lot of times, unfortunately, we don't see the full value until it's all said and done. And then we could look back and we see tremendous value that was ours because of that. But again, this word perfect is really important for us. Again, it's not perfection so much, but the design is to help us reach the goal. That's the design of all of that. And then, you know, so again, this perfect that's repeated in this, that may have its perfect work, that you may be perfect. This is important. I want to make sure that I'm not misunderstood. The goal of the first perfect is obviously of paramount importance. That's what all of us want. We want, as James will conclude this section with, is that crown of life. We want that home in heaven. But the second perfect, basically he's saying, the goal is not everything. There's enjoyment that I want you to gain while you're here. There is work that I need you to do while you're here, and the only way you're going to do that is if you count it all joy when you go through the trials. Jesus promised us in John 10, I have come to give you life abundantly. Here and now. It's not just heaven. And when I say that to myself, it sounds like I'm minimizing the importance of heaven, and I don't mean to say it that way. But there is abundant life to be had here and now, and God wants you to have that. And you have a purpose to fulfill while you're here, and you've got to go through these trials in order to get the full benefit out of that, in order to get the enjoyment out of life that God wants you to have. And, you know, to me, that's an important aspect to understand that these are two different perfects that he's trying to get us to get to, complete, lacking nothing. This whole idea of this complete, the same word is used about an inheritance. So it is the time at which a person gets their full inheritance, everything that was promised to them. And what we need to do, I think what James is trying to get us to understand, is we need to adopt the attitude that says, I will not allow a trial to steal my inheritance away from me. God promised me this inheritance. He promised it to me personally when I obeyed the gospel. It is mine, and I will not allow a trial to take it from me. Now again, that gets back to the let part. You can't allow. This is yours that God promised you. And you could turn that into a temptation and lose it all. Or you could take that attitude, I'm going to count it all joy and not lose my own inheritance. Yes, sir? Absolutely. Yes. It does, and I think that's where when we get to that level of our faith, when we realize that this inner strength is not within me but within God. And I'm glad you brought that up about the equipping part of it. It is a word. That word "perfect" again is the second one, is used to describe animals that are fully grown or children that have fully grown, and oftentimes it was used as a child that went through medical school and has now become a doctor, ready to take their education and put it into practice. Basically, you are perfect when you are now useful, is what that's saying. All before, you were learning. You were getting better and better and better and better. Now you have graduated from that, and now you're perfect. Because now God can use you. Because now your faith has been tested. Now you have been tried. You have been proved. The impurities are coming away. Now God can use you. And that's that equipping, I think, aspect of it. And that's what God wants. And all these trials, you know, these are not by accident. These are by design. Now, we don't like them, but that's what they are. And that's what they are for. And we're going to go through this at the end as far as where all these trials take us and what they ultimately will do for us. What... You know, I think the word maturity kind of comes to mind. What's the difference between children and adults in a lot of ways? Yeah. Yeah, maturity. I mean, a child, you know, we all, you know, if you have children, you know, they get, you know, they're selfish, you know, they're impatient, they want things the way they want them, right? And they're afraid of little things. I remember as a child, I remember getting my first shot, and my brother had scared me to death of this shot. And literally, I jumped off that table naked as a jaybird, and I was halfway out into the waiting room before the doctor and three nurses and my mother grabbed me and pulled me back in. And there wasn't this much screaming at the Salem witch hunts, I promise you. And they gave me this shot, right? Now, I go to the doctor, please give me a shot, because I know where that shot, it still doesn't tickle, it still hurts, but I know the benefit that comes from getting the shot, that I'm going to feel better in a lot faster time if I just go through that little bit of pain. As adults, we get that, right? But then why spiritually are we babies so many times? I didn't get my way. The elders did this. And we become spiritually immature when we don't get our way within God's kingdom. We're not mature. What's that? Lack of growth. And so these trials then help us get there. And we can't allow trials to take away our inheritance. And it ultimately leads us to that perfection, that being perfect and being fully equipped that's important. I'm going to skip this because I've gone through this before. In verses 5 through 8 then. If any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask God, who gives to all liberally and without reproach, and it will be given to him. But let him ask in faith with no doubting. For he who doubts is like a wave of the sea driven and tossed by the wind. For let not that man suppose that he will receive anything from the Lord. He is double-minded. He is a double-minded man, unstable in all his ways. And so now we get to that question, why? You know, does God give us the tools we need to get through all of this? And the answer, obviously, is yes. But we have to ask for it all. You know, it is this whole idea of the wisdom that we need in order to get through them. What, you know, wisdom? I think knowledge. Somebody said knowledge is the ability to take something apart, and wisdom is the ability to put it back together again. A lot of us can take things apart, but can't figure out where things went after we got it all apart, and now we got all these extra parts lying around. But that wisdom, then it takes that knowledge and how to take something apart, that wisdom enables us to put it back into place. And it shows us that our dependence is on God, that it is without ourselves, we can't get there. So we have to ask God for this wisdom, and He is the only source for the wisdom. And you know, this isn't a change of subjects here. He didn't just talk about trials and I'm going to switch and talk about wisdom. This kind of wisdom is the wisdom that helps me count all my trials with joy. That's what he's specifically still wanting us to look at trials in a joyous way. And the only way you're going to get there is with God's wisdom. If God gives you the wisdom, and He's going to give it to you if you ask Him for it. And you ask Him in the right way. You know, and it isn't one of those things. I think God is not an emergency God. I think one of the saddest verses in the Bible is when Samson runs out the last time to get the Philistines, and the Bible says, but he did not know the Lord had left him. It's the saddest verse in the Bible. And then he's overcome. God is not an emergency God. He wants to be our God every day. He wants us to rely. So as you don't know when the next trial is going to come, so you need to be praying now for this wisdom to help me get through all these trials that I may come in contact with tomorrow. I need that wisdom now. I don't want to wait till I'm halfway through the trial to ask God to help me deal with it. I need help now before it even begins. So we need to be constantly asking God for wisdom to get through the trials, the tribulations, those things in life that throw us off track. And it's important that we start that process now. And because these are opportunities. You know, if we start looking at our trials as actual opportunities for growth, opportunities for perfection, completeness, lacking nothing. If we don't ask for this wisdom, then we're still going to go through the trial. But we've wasted an opportunity. God is giving us an opportunity for growth, and we can't afford to waste those opportunities. So we're going to pick up right about there, around verse 9-ish or so. We're going to deal with some of it, because I think it's important that we understand these first 12 verses really are key to everything else that James is going to be dealing with throughout the other 4.5 chapters that we're going to talk about. So thank you for your comments. I appreciate it.